You ever get the feeling that everything in America is completely f***ed up?
Now, they're saying I should think stuff.
Something is wrong with me.
To be so cynical.
Practice.
Welcome back to the Positive Cynicism Year in Review of 1991, looking at the music, the trends in music to see where music was heading now with a 26-year hindsight. It's very obvious where things were heading that we really couldn't see at the time. There was one album that I forgot to mention on last week's episode from 91. Actually, there's two. I should say. We forgot to mention Van Halen's For Unlawful Carnal Knowledge, which came out in the summer of 91. I'm just pointing it out because Kevin had mentioned that was his favorite album from 1991.
Remember the video for Right Now? That was very popular, yeah. And they had a huge role. I think they had a huge tour off of that, off an album. And then they put out a live album on that, I think, the next year, maybe, yeah.
Yeah, I believe so, yeah. And, you know, the album was obviously popular for the acronym of For Unlawful Carnal Knowledge, which when it came out took me a few seconds to realize.
I don't think I ever did.
So I was like, F-U-C-N? That doesn't make sense. But the other album that was not listed and really I don't think had that big of an impact then as what one of the performers would go on to have on me now was an album called Tainted Angel by South Gang. You have anything for South Gang, Mike?
No, I do not.
South Gang was a band from Rome, Georgia, Atlanta, Georgia, who had come out to L.A. to make it big, and their album came out, again, in 91, I believe in August or I believe October of 91, which was not the best time, as we'll get into here in a few moments, for a hair band to be releasing an album.
They a hair band?
Is that oh, they was? Were very much a hair band, yes.
Wait, now, where was this at? Was this their first album? Or
this was their debut album. Okay. Second album would come out in 92, and that would be the end of South Gang. They would get rid of the lead singer, reform as a three-piece with the lead guitarist taking over vocal duties, be known as the Marvelous Three, release, I believe, three albums before the record label said, we're not going to support you anymore. They broke up to get out of their contract, and the lead singer went on to be a solo artist and record producer, and that man is Butch Walker, who I cannot stress enough that if you have not heard anything by Butch, go out, check it out, and especially his latest album, Stay Gold, which came out last year. That is just probably my favorite album of 2016.
Okay.
I also probably only heard like five albums from 2016, but still, it is still in my CD player today. So I just want to give a little shout out to South Gang and Butch Walker. And if you go back through the archives and listen to the episode that I did, episode 17, I believe it was, my favorite performers that I've seen live, Butch is on that list. But let's get back into 1991, and we ended last episode with talking about what is popular. Because even though we've discussed rap and hip-hop and the dwindling days of hair metal, there's no denying that still, even in 2017, that the driving force is pop music. Mm-hmm. You know, and we've mentioned this before, but looking at the list of top singles for the year, you know, your top 10 are Bryan Adams, Color Me Bad, CNC Music Factory, Paula Abdul, and other ones that we've mentioned before, with a little shout out to Extreme and More Than Words at number 7. It still pains me to know that is their most popular song. But pop music was driving force, and one of the aspects of pop music, I think, is just because it resonates with the largest audience.
Sure. I mean, and like you said, you also had, I mean, MTV was still huge, right? That would have been their 10th anniversary year.
Yeah, they actually had a 10th anniversary special. In August.
Oh yeah, like, and I think I highly recommend if you go on YouTube for the George Michael's performance of Freedom from the 10th anniversary MTV Freedom! Special. It's amazing. You gotta give for what you take. Freedom. You gotta give
Cause I was just a young boy, didn't know what I wanted to be.
But yeah, and those are the people who are still buying the records, and that's what's dominating the radio, and it's always what's going to be. It's just, it's pop music. And you said the videos were often on MTV. And so what was interesting is from 1988 or 89, when Hair Metal became popular, you know, that you still had, I mean, it was stuff that, like, we were listening to as kids. Our parents weren't listening to that, but the music that, you know, that our parents liked, 1991, they still had artists to listen to, and it was you would have had a combination of, like, you know, like, there would have been younger people or younger artists that were coming up that year. I mean, I say younger, but like Amy Grant, right? Baby was 1991.
Yeah, she had been a Christian artist for I don't know how many years, but she had a crossover pop hit with Baby.
Yeah, and then you had people like Rod Stewart, Bryan Adams, who had, I mean, Bryan Adams would have been more of our generation, Rod Stewart more of our parents, but, I mean, and I mentioned my father was a big fan of Vanessa Williams, and she saved the best for last. One of her biggest singles came out that year as well. You know, Gloria Estefan, I think we already discussed, she had an album. And so, at the same time, we were listening to, like you said, the hair bands, hip-hop music, those ones were becoming kind of popular. You know, and but at the same time, pop music was still sort of there. You know, there was enough room for younger people to listen to a genre of music that became popular. At the same time, the older people still had, for lack of a better word, adult contemporary that was sort of dominate. You can call the pop music, like Mariah Carey. You know, Mariah Carey would have been big in 1990, was her first album. In 91, she had her second album, Emotions, and that was just, you know, had several hits, and, you know, Make It Happen and Can't Let Go. And I, you know, again, I go back to, you always base it on, like, what your dad listens to, what your mom listens to. I mean, my dad liked Mariah Carey, you know, Whitney Houston was still around. I think her I'm Your Baby Tonight, we said, was in 1990, but the singles from that album were still coming, were, you know, All the Man That I Need, you know, and she still had hits into 1991.
Yeah, because this was the time still before digital downloads where an album would release one single at a time, so you could stretch out a album for a year and a half to 2 years, sure. Whereas now, you get six singles in 6 weeks.
That's true, yeah. And like you said, and the funny thing I forgot with Whitney was 1991 was also the famous national anthem at the Super Bowl. That was when the Gulf War happened in January, and then she recorded the national anthem and then lip-synced it at the Super Bowl, but that was released as a single, her version of the national anthem. But
yeah, and it's interesting because I'm looking here at the top album chart for the year, and, you know, I just read the top 10 or went over kind of the top 10 of singles, which were all pop-related with the exception of Extreme, but that song was very pop-ish.
That's a pop song, yeah.
But looking at for the year in review of albums, you know, from January to February, the top album was Vanilla Ice. And then followed up by Mariah Carey, self-titled album, was number one from March 2nd to May 11th. And then you had R.E.M. had a couple weeks. Michael Bolton and Paula Abdul, again, those were the pop, what you would expect. But then a little band called N.W.A. had a number one album. And then SoundScan took over. And as we discussed last week, with the invention of SoundScan, albums that normally would not have been recorded as selling as many albums are now reaching higher chart position. Mm. And so you have Skid Row, Slave to the Grind, Van Halen's For Unlawful Carnal Knowledge, Metallica, Guns N' Roses, and Garth Brooks released his second album, which had several weeks at the top spot before the end of the year when Michael Jackson's Dangerous took over for the last two or three weeks. The last 3 weeks. But so even though albums are selling more, your pop artists are more single, I guess you could say, are more single based.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, they have the control on the Casey Kasem Top 40 or...
Sure. And I think, I don't know, was it 1991? that Natalie Cole did her duet with her father, Unforgettable, and that was number one. That album was number one for a long time that summer.
Yeah, it had 5 weeks from the end of July through August.
Yeah. I mean, and it was Natalie Cole. I mean, she'd been around. Mm-hmm. She had done some kind of pop stuff. She'd done some R&B, but it was like that. It somehow struck a nerve. I mean, I'm pretty sure that album was mostly like standards. And it was, I mean, I know, and I don't, it wasn't like it was all just stuff with her and her father, but that song was everywhere. And I believe that was the big winner at the Grammys in 1992 was, and I'm pretty sure that's the one that won album and record and all those, you know, mm-hmm. Song of the Year and whatnot. But it wasn't like that video. Was that video on MTV? Do you remember that?
I'm sure they played it, but...
VH1, more like.
Yeah, probably. I don't know. Yeah, it's just a weird... I guess trying to separate popular from... You know, we were discussing earlier before we started recording about how these popular songs we were aware of, but in our circle, you know, how many of your friends were listening to this music? Or I shouldn't say listening to the music. I should say buying the albums.
Oh, sure.
Because everyone's at the time listening to the radio.
It would have been more your parents and right. your aunt and uncle, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, like I said, if you want to look at that 1991 pop year, like I listed a few albums that I thought were struck out. But it's funny because a lot of those are ones that you look back as we've both gotten older. We joke about how music that was like stuff that our parents would have listened to when we were younger. Now we're older and we're like we kind of appreciate it. And you said 1991, when we first came up with this idea of doing this podcast, you specifically told me, you were like, I'm not going to touch upon everybody on every album that came out that year. You know, you're like, Rod Stewart put out an album that year. And it's like, no, Rod Stewart put out a huge album that year. You know, where it was like, the album was Vagabond Heart, and it was loaded with singles. I mean, like, and I'm pretty sure, you know, you and I saw him in concert at the Hollywood Bowl, and when he did, you know, he did the Motown song, and it brought the house down, and that was another one, the huge single from 1991, and, I mean, that album was mostly covers, but it had Rhythm on My Heart, and it had Downtown Train, and it was sort of like you said, at the time it would have been funny to think that was our parents' music, but yet, we didn't appreciate it then, but we can appreciate it now.
I mean, I remember the Motown song video. And I like the song, but am I going to rush out as a 17-year-old kid going out and buying a Rod Stewart album?
Mm-hmm.
No.
But did you, I would consider this pop music, but did you get the single or did you listen to the song Crazy by Seal?
I did not.
That was a big hit in 1991. I remember that video being on a lot. I don't know, do you call it R&B? Did you call it pop? I mean, that was kind of a big hit.
Although I believe Rod Stewart had, off that same album... Have I Told You Lately?
Yes, that's true.
I did buy that single for my girlfriend.
Did you really?
For my girlfriend, yeah.
Did you know it was a cover when you first heard it?
I believe so.
Yeah.
I believe so, yeah.
It's one of those weird ones I always joke about. You know, it's not a cover if you don't know it's not a cover, then it's not a cover.
I did not know Cats in the Cradle was a cover the first time I heard Ugly Kid Joe.
Ugly Kid Joe?
And that's probably like the fifth or sixth version of that song to be done. So.
But yeah, and then the funny thing was, like I just mentioned, you would have had Rod Stewart doing music for your parents, but then you also had like a guy like Bryan Adams, who we would have also still been listening to him. I mean, we were listening to him when he did Reckless back in the early 80s, and you know, and he did Cuts Like a Knife and stuff. We all kind of liked him. But then in 91 was the, what's it called, Waking Up the Neighbors? Yeah, Waking Up the Neighbors was 91. And it's almost as if that time, this artist that we loved less than 10 years ago, he kind of got a little sappy, right? And he made the biggest single of the year, Everything I Do It For You. I love Cuts Like a Knife and Gonna Run to You. I didn't care for the Robin Hood song. Like, I mean, I don't remember, I didn't run out and buy that album.
I mean, I remember liking the song, but yeah, I think the only Bryan Adams song that I had, or album that I had was Reckless.
Yeah.
So it's not like, again, I appreciate his music. It's just not someone that I would put on and listen to by choice.
Yeah, and it's fascinating because I've since run out and got the Bryan Adams' Greatest Hits album, the So Far, So Good, So What, which is a very good album. And one of my favorite songs on that album was on Waking Up the Neighbors, and it's a ballad called Do I Have to Say the Words? And I remember hearing it maybe on the radio at somewhat in 1991, didn't care for it, but now, all these three decades later, right, I'm listening to it, and you're like, why did I not appreciate that in 1991? Because I was too busy listening to hair metal.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, looking at these charts, these songs, I'm familiar with them, I like them, but it wasn't what I was listening to.
Mm-hmm.
So even though, I mean, looking at the list, yes, I had Paula Abdul's album, and really, that's it. I had
really?
Paula Abdul,
Paula Abdul one?
But
also, yeah. 1991, Bonnie Raitt's Luck of the Draw, which had, I mean, I Can't Make You Love Me, still one of the most beautiful songs ever written. And then Something to Talk About was on that. I mean, that was, those, I'm trying to think, like, do you remember, I don't remember those videos being on MTV. I mean, it may be Something to Talk About, maybe. Because that's a video that had, was that the video that had Dennis Quaid in it? Or is that, am I thinking of the movie?
That the movie and had Julie Roberts,
yeah. Okay,
that's right. But yeah, that would probably been on TNN, the national network, and CMT.
Okay, at the time. Yeah.
But yeah, it's, I don't know, it's interesting just looking at pop music, and even now, in 2017, looking at what's pop and being like, who is actually buying this?
Yeah, and can you pin it down into one particular like genre or whatnot? Because there's one more artist I was going to mention as far as the pop discussion, but then does he fall into pop? And that's Prince.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in 1991 he did Diamonds and Pearls, which was like, you know, it was kind of R&B, but was it soul? I mean, the title track Diamonds and Pearls, that's a pop song. But then that he also had Get Off on there, which was like the really sexy sort of funk R&B song. Like, so the very famous performance of the Video Music Awards when he had the pants that didn't have a butt in them. Cream is on that album, right? That's pretty much a pop song. That was, you know, but at the same time, when we saw Prince in concert at the Forum when he did all those shows, he did Cream and brought the house down. It's like, even though he had much bigger songs, maybe bigger songs that were more danceable, but yet these sort of pop songs, he could do, but I guess he could do whatever he wanted.
Prince could do whatever, whenever. And speaking of being in concerts, too, and this is something I should have looked up. I didn't even think about this aspect. These pop artists that were ruling the charts, how did their tours do that year?
Well, was Madonna still doing? Was she still in Blonde Ambition? I think, or no? She would have been done
maybe
with
in
by
early
now.
'91. Because yeah. When did Truth or Dare?
Truth or Dare came out. I think Truth or Dare came out in '91.
Okay,
but the Blonde Ambition tour was '90, I guess. And I mean, Prince was still
Dick
been touring. Yeah, and Whitney Houston. Yeah, was Dick Tracy 91? No, it's late 90. Like it was 90. Like Christmas of 90, right?
A summer of 90, I thought.
Okay, so then she performed at the Oscars when she showed up with Michael Jackson in 1991. Yeah, okay. But yeah, I mean, it was. I guess we can discuss that later. But yeah, what was there? I didn't do enough research to know if there were like any huge like pop tours. I mean, unfortunately, I remember Gloria touring that year when she had her bus crash. But. Oh, well, there was... Okay, one more. Sorry, I got one more on here. Genesis put out We Can't Dance. And they used to do massive tours because they were big in every country all over the world. And so, you know, We Can't Dance, obviously... The I Can't Dance video, I remember being on really a lot. And it was so funny because that was one of the ones that my dad liked that one, you know. And Hold On My Heart, Jesus, He Knows Me, that was a video where they were, like, dressed like televangelists. That was kind of a... That got a lot of play on MTV just because of how goofy it was. But, you know, and so they were still, and they were always one of the biggest touring acts, you know.
Well, thanks to the magic of the internet, I have this article here that talks about 1991 tour business-wise. It doesn't really say too much about what tours were popular, but it says tours of 91 were down by about 25% over 1990 when the top-selling tour, the second highest-grossing tour ever, was New Kids on the Block, Hanging Tough. Tour, which is kind of shocking, but not really. But in 91, the top act was Grateful Dead, and I'm trying to think when Jerry Garcia died. So I want to say that was 92 or 93.
I was in Kentucky, so it would have been 95,
okay.
I believe, yeah.
Okay, maybe later. It doesn't really matter, because in 91, the Grateful Dead was still touring, and number one. But other than that, there were three country acts in the top 10 tours of 91, and those were the Judds, who were on their farewell tour. Yeah, the Judds were on their farewell tour, and then you had Clint Black, who I'm surprised was in the top 10.
Wow.
And then there was a little country star who had released his third album in 1991, who went on to, I think, have some success. His name was Garth Brooks. And so, yeah, so you're looking at tours of 91, and it doesn't seem like to be... I mean, you had Lollapalooza that year started, mm-hmm. and like we said last time, Guns N' Roses were out before their album came out. Metallica released... I want to say the Black Tour started in 91.
I'm guessing.
Started in Peoria. I do remember that. But yeah, so touring wasn't... Even though music was popular, tours were down. Other than country artists were starting to emerge. And in 91, as just mentioned, Garth Brooks released his Roping the Wind album, which was on the top charts for bouncing back and forth during, I believe, October. And then really in the spring of 92... Still number one on the charts.
That's one of the ones we said benefited from SoundScan, right? Where it was like, I'm sure country albums would have hit the chart, hit number one before that, but that one, Garth seemed to have a lot of staying power.
Yeah, and I believe he won Entertainer of the Year at the CMAs the next year. And really at this time is when country music is also emerging, probably due to the help of SoundScan. People are realizing it is popular. CMT and the Nashville Network are probably getting into more households.
Well, it's funny you say that because my parents were big country music fans, and when we lived in Hawaii, the cable channel, the cable system that we had, did not have CMT, and in this we had this weird arrangement where we had the Nashville Network TNN, but only for like part of the day, and then the other part of the day was like infomercials. And so we moved, like, so we moved to Kentucky in January of 92, and my parents, just like I was with BET, because I could watch rap videos, my parents were ecstatic because they now had TNN full time and they had CMT. And so I started seeing a lot of these albums that had come out in 1991. The singles were still in the charts and still being, the videos were still being played on country music radio or the videos into 92. And so, like you said, Garth was especially popular. I remember being at a party one night, and it must have been a birthday party or something, and they were all singing Friends in Low Places, which I think that was on the album beforehand.
That was on No Fences,
but then it was just like, okay, this guy is around, and it was like, oh, is that from the new album? Yeah. Oh, no, it's not, but he kind of took over in 1991.
Yes, definitely. Yeah. And you had Reba McEntire, who was out, and like you said, popular, and unfortunately, there's no such thing as bad news type publicity. As you mentioned, Gloria Estefan had her bus crash earlier in 91. Reba McEntire, her band and tour manager, were killed in a plane crash in early 92, in early 91. Mm-hmm. So that probably helped get some
notoriety,
attention onto her, you know, helping her latest album kind of climb the charts. And then, as we said, with Garth, with Clint Black, I believe Brooks and Dunn would have came out in 91, 90, early 92.
91, Boots, Scoot, and Boogie by Brooks and Dunn. That was a huge song in 1991.
Yeah. And then going into 92, as we saw in our research before they went on, you know, there was a little country song called Achy Breaky Heart that came out and took the world by storm. And Billy Ray Cyrus had a number one album for like 2 months.
Yeah. And I mean, but yeah, that may have been the culmination of that, because it was so funny. Was at least in 1991, you had established artists that were still, you know, like you said, the Judds were doing their farewell tour. I saw that Alan Jackson had an album, Don't Rock the Jukebox. That song was, the title track was really popular. You would have had, I mean, you were some new artists. I mean, Trisha Yearwood was in 1991, her self-titled debut album, and She's in Love with the Boy, that single, when it was everywhere, and it's still, I hear, when Trisha plays with Garth at her shows now, she still does that song, it still is really popular. But yeah, what's so funny was, you know, you say Alan Jackson and Garth, you said Clint Black was still touring, Reba was still out there. The fact that Billy Ray Cyrus, who was the epitome of one-hit wonder in the country music world, could sustain a number one album on the charts for that long in 1992 shows you what 1991 did, especially with SoundScan, right?
Yeah, and, you know, looking at 2017, Billy Ray is still around. Maybe not musically. He's kind of transitioned into an actor. You know, he's got a show on TMT right now, CMT.
Really?
Yeah.
What was he saying? He had that show to play the doctor. It was on PAX TV for the longest time.
And,
Doc?
Yeah, and then he had a little show. He was a supporting character on a little Disney Channel show called Hannah Montana for a few years. Yeah. I don't know whatever happened to that lead actress.
I don't know.
But yeah, country was starting to make its comeback, although I think in the scheme of things, country music kind of ebbs and flows more so than other genres, because country is always reestablishing itself, or re-morphing, if you will. Mm-hmm. And in the later part of the 90s, you know, the, what used to be the hair metal bands, or that bands that would have been hair metal, are now doing more country, or I should say country is doing more hair metal-esque sounding songs, just with fiddles and steel guitars.
And kind of, and like I said, and then when did country music become so image-based? Like, I mean, growing growing up, my parents were country music fans, and I mean, it was, they were listening to George Strait, Randy Travis. These were just guys with cowboy hats and stuff. And then all of a sudden, I want to say, as the 90s progressed, and you had, I kind of pin it on Faith Hill, and I don't mean it as a bad thing, but all of a sudden you had this sort of bombshell. Like, I mean, because Reba was big hair and fringe and shoulder pads, right? I mean, I guess you would have had like Tanya Tucker, who was just sort of a little minx. But yeah, it seems like when Faith Hill, and then you, the even the male singers, all of a sudden they were all tans, you know? I mean, when was Kenny Chesney and McGraw, Tim McGraw, and those guys were, these were, they were ripped, right? This kind of, I think when country music sort of adapted into pop, maybe you could say it charts back to 1991, because now you had, you didn't have to just look at the country chart. Mm-hmm. You could look at the pop chart. The sound was
Yeah, because Garth debuted at both number one on country and pop charts. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you'd made the comment after we, in the last year, we have seen Garth Brooks in concert, and we saw the Dixie Chicks in concert. Mm-hmm. And granted, the Dixie Chicks have kind of had a little falling out with country music over the last decade. But as you said, neither of those concerts were country concerts.
Oh, no. Those were rock shows.
Yeah,
those were just as good, if not better, than a number of rock concerts I've seen in my life, to where they could pack an arena and just burn the house down. You know?
Yeah, and I know there is a lot of debate over what is country now, because, you know, when you have country acts doing duets with Nelly or other rap or hip hop stars, and they're performing at the country music award shows with this. Is it still country? Is it pop country? You know, there's always going to be the people like, well, it's not Johnny Cash or Waylon or, you know.
But is it a natural evolution, though? Do you think does it feel organic, or does it seem forced?
I think it depends on the artist.
You know?
I mean, there's obviously, as with any genre, there are going to be those that are marketed and, you know, told, wear this, do this song, because country music is more covering other people's songs, or having songwriters for you, as opposed to writing your own songs.
True.
You're going to look for songs that fit a specific image.
But I wonder, like, I know that Dixie Chicks did that song with Beyonce, and then Beyonce played at the CMT Awards, and people were out of shape, but of course the Dixie Chicks don't care, and that's why we love them. But it's the idea that I'm sure that I think it's a problem, people don't want to admit this, but I'm sure there are people who are dyed-in-the-wool country music fans that probably don't like the idea that their favorite country stars are listening to rap music, are listening to, you know, anything. You know, I remember, and this is kind of a slight segue, I went to a screening of a documentary about Rush. I'm a huge fan of the band Rush. And they were about to get inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame like a month later. And so they showed this documentary, and then Alex and Getty were there to do a Q&A. And I raised my hand. I actually got to do a question during the Q&A, and I was so nervous. And I asked them, I said, is there anybody that you're excited about being inducted with? That, you know, because I was kind of baiting them, because that year they got inducted with Public Enemy. And I was very curious to see if they were going to reference that, kind of like you said, Anthrax and Public Enemy. And to my surprise, Alex, the first artist that he mentioned was Donna Summer. And people were just kind of like surprised. And he said, don't pretend like you didn't listen to that. You know, because he's like, we were huge in the 70s until it was Donna Summer. And I'm sure that, like, that you know, I'm sure there's probably a lot of people that like the Dixie Chicks, whether they like them because they're anti-establishment, or they like them just because they're good music. But they're going to have to realize that the Dixie Chicks probably listen to Beyonce. They love Beyonce. And so a collaboration between the two of them only seems natural to me. But, and it's, country music does not look like it was like it did in the 60s and 70s. You and I both went to the Country Music Hall of Fame, and it was very interesting, very fascinating to see what it was like. And I mean, maybe you view it as a music of the South, which is maybe that's an area of the country that's generally known as that generic term, quote unquote, conservative, where they kind of have a certain way of life, and that they like a slower pace of life, and they don't want change, you know. But at the same time, it's like maybe some of them want, maybe these country artists want to be relevant, or they want to ascend to something greater than just being pigeonholed into their genre. And so they can, I guess you can kind of look at Garth for that, because I know people that didn't listen to country music, but we all kind of like Garth. We all kind of thought he was a cool dude. And I mean, did you ever see his? I saw it on CBS when he did his one man show from Vegas, mm-hmm. where he went through the history of rock music, just him and an acoustic guitar. And I mean, I'm sure it would have been a hell of a show to see in Vegas, but the CBS special was pretty cool.
Yeah, I know. At the same time he did that CBS special, he released a box set of a bunch of covers of songs, mm-hmm. none of which I can tell you right now what was on the album. But I know he did that. But yeah, I think it. I mean, you bring up a good point with, and I saw this with, you know, friends who listen to hair metal, friends who listen to punk, thrash, hardcore metal. It's like people who will only listen to one style of music and disregard anything else as being good because it's not what I listen to. Mm-hmm. And I think that is a very, just a very suffocating worldview where I want to go back. I believe it was a quote by Butch Walker who said when someone asked him about some pop song, he's like, a good pop song is a good, or a good song is a good song no matter what genre.
Sure.
So, you know, even though it may not be your cup of tea, there is good music out there. And, you know, we can go into a whole another 20 or 60 minute discussion about there is still good music out there, even if you don't like what's popular today. Because, mm-hmm. and while we're on the topic of country, I'm going to throw a little plug in for a band that probably is not that popular right now. And that's a band called Striking Matches, which, if you have not heard of them, check them out. We saw them at the Grand Ole Opry almost 2 years ago and had no idea who they were, and they lit the stage on fire, basically.
I woke up this morning with the pounding in my brain. I don't know where I am or how I will explain. The congregation whispered when I walk in late. Or straighten up if only for my mama's sake. Everybody says I lost my mind. And I'm with you, I guess I see why. I'm saying things I never say, doing things that I don't do. You're no good for me, and they say I'm too good for you. Ooh, but I can't help myself when you're around. Trouble is, trouble does, and I'm in trouble now.
How big are they getting in the country world? Because they got a rock tinge. You can tell that they probably are from, they're from Nashville, but I'm willing to bet they probably had parents who listened to AC/DC. You know what I mean? Or were listen, or maybe even listened to hair metal. Because they're probably young enough. Both of them are still in their, both of the it's a duo. Both of them are still in their, probably in their 20s, I don't believe. Or haven't reached their 30s, I should say. And so they were raised by people like my older sister, you know, mm-hmm. and I can imagine they probably were listening to some of the music that came out in 1991, yeah. surprisingly. You know, but like you said, where was country music at when you went off to college? You said it was still, was it just a handful of friends who were listening to it?
I did not have friends that were really listening to country. Although my freshman year of college, I got paired up with the only guy in the dorm who listened to country music. Mm-hmm. So that's when I, like, to this day, I do not like Boot Scootin' Boogie because I just heard it so much.
Yeah.
But then through college, when I, as I mentioned, I think on the first show, it's or the first episode of this 91 review, it's I started producing a country music video show. And so I started to familiarize myself with country music. And there was a lot of videos that we played by bands that you've never heard of. Mm-hmm. Because country was kind of a flash in the pan. Country music is, I think, even one of the worst genres of music for sustainability.
It's, oh, sure.
If you're either big and you achieve superstar status, such as a Garth or Kenny Chesney, Tim McGraw.
Carrie Underwood now, right?
Carrie Underwood. But if you're just a mediocre artist, we talked about the hair bands on the last episode, like Winger, Bullet Boys, Trickster, these bands that are still out there playing today, mm-hmm. and have a small following. But country artists, because they're not getting played on any radio, mm-hmm. you know.
They're probably playing shows in the Nashville area, but that's
still trying to make a break. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think, and I think, if you want to, when it comes to 1991, yeah, you're right. It does. It all comes back to Garth, because I think he does not get enough. Maybe he does get enough credit, because it seems like he sort of opened up and showed everybody, hey, it's not just for people in the Deep South. Again, I was living in Hawaii, and we knew mm-hmm. who Garth was. And I always point it back to when I knew, like, we all thought Garth was kind of cool, but I knew he was really cool would have been 1994 when he appeared on the Kiss tribute CD doing a version of Hard Luck Woman. And I vividly remember him and Kiss appearing on the Tonight Show,
yeah,
and doing that song. And I mean, Jay loved Garth, right? You know, and so Garth was on the Tonight Show a lot. But that was specifically one of those moments where it's like, okay, this isn't just country, this is rock.
Right, and as you mentioned about growing up with those influences, I remember attending a Garth Brooks press conference in 96, and one of the hosts of the show that I was producing asked him, because Kiss was going out on the reunion tour at that time, he's like, any chance of you doing like a co-tour with Kiss? And he was like, probably not, but if you see a guy in the crowd with his face painted like the American flag, that's going to be me. That's because that's the music he grew up on.
Mm-hmm. And then when was the Chris Gaines experiment?
I believe that was 99, and we shall never speak of that again.
Well, no, we should, because he that's why it makes him so great, because he was the one that took that chance, and it failed horribly because of the fact that, I mean, not maybe, again, I don't know it. I don't remember it, because it was sort of a pop record, right? And it seemed like a lot of the fans just did not want to hear it, because, again, sometimes they like their music a certain way. But yeah, at the same time, to pull it back to SoundScan and the charts, you said Garth was, he was there, then he wasn't, and it seems like it's weird to look at from the fall of 91 into the spring of 92, where Garth is number one off and on his, that Rope in the Wind album is number one off and on, but in the middle of that comes Michael Jackson's Dangerous. And what I found was really interesting was, I believe he was, it was only number one on the charts for, I want to say, maybe a week or two. At the end of the year, okay, it was basically the number one album through the month of December. And then in January, it gets unseated by Nirvana's Nevermind, which brings us to, I think, where we were kind of going when you originally pitched this idea of this podcast, which was, how different was music in 1991, where you had Vanilla Ice was on the charts and at the beginning of the year, Mariah Carey, who still had a huge album from 1990 that had carried over into 1991. But by the end of the year, the biggest star in the world was about to be knocked off of the number one chart, the number one album chart, from a grunge band. Mm-hmm. And a grunge band Nevermind had come out in September, right around the time of Metallica's Black Album. And of course, they were still huge, so Nevermind didn't really do nothing.
And it came out a week after Use Your Illusions 1 and 2.
Use Your Illusion, yeah. And so, and then by the time 1991 ends, you had me watch this MTV Year in Rock 1991 special, and I thought it was so interesting that they talk about Lollapalooza. They did a whole segment about Guns N' Roses. They get their own feature all to themselves. But at the very end, they talk about some of the new artists coming out to keep an eye on 92, and they mentioned Nirvana. There's a little band called Nirvana. They're like, oh yeah, they're gonna, we'll keep an eye on them next year, not knowing that they would. I'm sure if you watched the Year in Rock 1992 MTV special, probably all they talked about, or one of the main reasons people they talk about.
Yeah, you had Nevermind came out, as we said, in September. Pearl Jam, the 10 album, came out in 91 as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe we mentioned this before, but Soundgarden's Bad Motor Finger album came out, which I don't really consider grunge, but they're from Seattle. They were still in that same circle.
That's a metal album. I mean, do you remember? I remember Soundgarden being on Headbangers Ball.
I also remember Nirvana being on Headbangers Ball and hosting Headbangers Ball. So that's where this whole subgenre of labeling grunge or alternative music is. Where do you split hairs and define music?
Yeah, because I mean, we talked about REM before. That was those were the sort of the college rock bands. And everybody joked about, like, you know, alternative music. There was hardly any room on the radio dial for them. You never saw anybody talking about it. And 120 Minutes on MTV was more about those really obscure bands who were still around from the 80s, maybe. But then the next thing you know, yeah, alternative becomes the mainstream. And then sort of Kurt Cobain becomes, for lack of a better word, he becomes sort of the voice of that generation, right? And of course, he didn't want to be. You know, Eddie Vedder probably should have been, you know, he's still around. And just like we kind of a mat. I think we kind of all knew. I mean, I don't want to pretend like I totally picked Pearl Jam to be the band that was going to make it, but I think we figured they would be around for a while.
Yeah, I think, well, I mean, there's so many different directions to go with that comment, where we've discussed many times before that what helped Nirvana's legacy is the fact that they're not around. That Kurt Cobain isn't around anymore. He's like Jimi Hendrix. He's like Jim Morrison, to where you don't know what they would have done had they lived. Mm-hmm. Had Kiss broken up in 1977 at the height of Rock and Roll Day, they never would have put out a disco album. Everybody would have been like, oh, they're, you know, a great rock band.
Sure.
So, you know, it's Nirvana's legacy obviously is the focal point of the grunge movement, but as we kind of hinted on the last episode, was Nirvana popular because the album was just going to succeed anyway, or were they popular because MTV decided they wanted to go in a new direction and that was a band they were promoting because Geffen was putting money behind them?
Yeah, but were people, I mean, do you remember, were, but at the same time, were a lot of people calling, requesting the Teen Spirit video on dialing TV? You know, and I'm sure were people calling their radio stations to hear that song? You know, it seems like, I think when it comes to SoundScan, Nevermind doesn't hit number one until January, and it's only number one for a week or two. And
I believe it debuted at, what did it say,
144? Yeah. And then the Soul's 18 Spirit single only got up to number six. I mean, I don't want to downplay it. It's still a top 10 single, but I'm sure people were still, like I said, they were probably still calling on the radio station. The video was still getting airplay. And then, wisely, Nirvana was cranking out another video and another video. I mean, they did, you know, Come As You Are had a video. Lithium had a video. I know there was another one. In Bloom.
Okay.
In Bloom had a video with Doug Llewellyn from People's Court. And it looks like an old black and white TV show. And then Nirvana was on Saturday Night Live. And so, I mean, maybe that's... It's weird. It is because you say, did they get big? Did the fans make them big? Or did the media make them big?
And I have this going through my head, so I'm going to throw it out there as an example, is later in 99, when Kid Rock became popular, who had put out three albums, I believe, prior to Devil Without a Cause. Mm-hmm. But on Devil Without a Cause, he keeps rapping about how big he is and how he's selling a million albums. Mm-hmm. Well, he hadn't sold a million albums before that album came out, but when that album came out, boom, now all of a sudden he's all over MTV. He's all over this place. So is it just a good coincidence, or is there something behind? Because
album good? I don't know it enough.
I mean, it's for a 1999 album. Yeah, it's good. Is it going to go down in the top albums of all time? No.
Because I remember, you know, kind of in the same vein, you know, when Kanye West came out, you know, you'd been hearing about the, I heard about this guy. He's something of a producer, and he worked with Jay-Z. And then this first record comes out, and like, I knew guys that were listening to Pavement and listening to a lot of total alt-rock stuff, and they liked Kanye. And I was just, it's like, oh, how good can it be? And then I listened to it, you know, he talks about how big he's going to be, or how much he wants to get big. And it was everywhere, it seemed like, that year. I didn't hear it for, it's actually a couple of years later before I finally heard it, and then it was like, yeah, you know, it is really good. That's why I was curious about the Kid Rock one, because I'm like, it's funny if he talks about it being good, and then you listen to it, you're like, oh, he's actually pretty good. I can see why he backed it up.
Yeah, he backed it up. For that time, had he put out that album today, no. And there's a reason why he's probably gone more of a country route than staying with the rap stuff.
Yeah, but what's interesting about Nirvana, though, is like, I mean, you saw how big that album got. And I remember, kind of to go back to what I said before, where I was listening to hair metal, and then the guy who recommended Skid Row was now listening to Eazy-E. I was listening to rap music in 1991, and then I moved to Kentucky in 92, and I had friends who were listening to rap music, but they had Nevermind. You know, or they had 10 by Pearl Jam. Like, they still knew these were good albums, even though we're listening to hip-hop. And again, it helped that the videos were on a lot as well.
Yeah, I mean, I remember the Smells Like Teen Spirit being, the video being on a lot. And I ended up buying the album based on the strength of that video.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, for me, being a child of the 80s who grew up on the hair metal scene, I think part of me was reluctant to see that die, and I kind of let it go kicking and screaming. Mm-hmm. So I never got into the grunge. I mean, yes, I bought Nevermind, I bought 10, and then I had Versus and Vitology, but I don't think I've ever listened to Vitology all the way through.
Oh, that's good help.
I never had In Utero.
Yeah.
To me, the grunge movement happened for about 6 months, and then I moved on to something else.
Yeah, and what I find kind of funny is, I mean, again, I was listening to Nevermind. I never had the album, but I remember friends would have it. You go to the mall, someone would be listening to it in their car. You just heard it. In a weird way, I didn't really get heavily into Nirvana until after Kurt died. Like, I just remember, like, they did the Unplugged. And we all, I think everyone pretty much watched the Nirvana Unplugged. Mm. I mean, that was a big event. And then after he died, it was like, kind of like happened with Michael Jackson. I think there's a lot of us, I'll admit that I listened to Michael Jackson growing up, of course, stopped listening to him for a while. And then after he died, you kind of go, oh my God, why was I not listening to this guy? I'm sure there's probably a lot of people right now that are doing that with Prince. And hopefully, people are doing that with David Bowie. But
and Glenn Campbell.
Glenn Campbell, yeah, sure. But I remember going out and going back and buying Nevermind after he died. And because I think I joined Columbia House around 94, and that's when I went and got Soundgarden and Pearl Jam and kind of caught up on all my Nirvana stuff. And what I find interesting is that, you know, who knows how big they would have gotten or how big they would have stayed, because Kurt kept wanting to take them in different directions. And I know that, like, when they made In Utero, like I said, he brought in Steve Albini, which to produce it, who had done some stuff with PJ Harvey and the Pixies. And that album, I'm sure if you gave somebody Nevermind and In Utero, they would probably respond more to Nevermind because it was a little bit more polished, about as polished as Nirvana is ever going to be. But In Utero was just a grungy, well, for lack of a better word, kind of a nasty, it's lo-fi, you know. And Heart-Shaped Box, I remember that video was a big deal because it was like, oh my God, Nirvana has a new album, and this thing was huge, but they didn't make any other videos off that album. Now, granted, maybe they didn't have enough time. You know, I vividly remember Nirvana, they did a concert on New Year's Eve 1993, and MTV showed it live. They showed the Breeders were somewhere else. They showed the Breeders because for about four or five songs, and then they showed a Nirvana concert. And I've since went back again after he died. I went back and bought. I found an Italian import CD that had that live concert from it, and I think they even showed it on TV. Maybe it must have been an anniversary of Kurt's death of some sort. They kind of went back and MTV showed the Unplugged, and they showed this live concert of theirs from 1993. And I remember it being like, even though it was only 2 years later, it wasn't like, it was like, oh, okay, Nirvana's on TV. You know, it was kind of like the Foo Fighters now. You're like, oh yeah, they're really good, but it wasn't, you know, you gotta stop what you're doing. I mean, it was still New Year's Eve. I mean, people probably watching Dick Clark and whatnot. But they were, you know, give it two more years, because Kurt would have died in April of 94. Mm-hmm. By 1995, maybe they're still, I mean, the alternative rock, for lack of a better word, you want to call it that. I mentioned to you before, the radio station I listened to in St. Louis, they advertised themselves as modern rock. And that was what we kind of, you know, that's what I kind of ascribed to, because it would have your Chili Peppers, which I guess they sort of alternative, but then it also had, you know, heavier stuff, Alice in Chains, Soundgarden, which is not all, I wouldn't consider that alternative. It's grunge. Those bands were, they said Alice in Chains was all over Headbangers Ball. They were a metal band when they came out, right?
It's just, it was alternative to hair metal.
Yeah. And that, so, but yeah, so if Nirvana's still around 96, you know, Soundgarden breaks up in 97, you know, Pearl Jam's still making rock music. That they shifted their sound a little bit to where it just sounds like good old fashioned rock music. It sounds like some of the stuff that we listened to when we were younger. It sounds like some of the Van Halen, sounds like some of the Bryan Adams, you know. But then when you get into the late 90s and then the boy bands show up, what would Nirvana have been like in the late 90s? Like, if they were still around? Because you wouldn't have the Foo Fighters, essentially, right? I mean, or would they? Would Dave have been like George Harrison, that had just so much stuff saved up that as soon as Nirvana took a break, any kind of a break, I'm sure Kurt would have probably gone out and done a solo record, or would have written a book and done a book tour. I'm sure Dave, because Dave's, the first Foo Fighters album is all Dave. He records every instrument on a multi-track recorder, and then he finds a band to tour with him that year. And I saw them in concert on that tour. We wouldn't have had them, and Nirvana would have still been, I don't know, would they have been like Pearl Jam or even Tool, where they're taking years between albums, and they're off, you know, oh, Chris Novoselic is going to do some painting, you know?
Yeah, it would be interesting to see what Nirvana did. Again, I will hold the opinion that had Kurt Cobain lived, Foo Fighters would have burnt out rather than fade away.
Foo Fighters?
Or not Foo Fighters. Nirvana would have burnt out. Like, I don't think they would have stuck around, because I don't think, one, Kurt wanted that limelight. So I think he would have broken the band up at some point.
He would have gotten bored.
Yeah.
I think he would have gotten really bored with it at a certain point. I would not have been surprised if maybe him and Courtney would have done something. Some sort of a collaboration of some kind.
One that would rival John and Yoko, I am sure.
Hey,
yeah, no, it's interesting. But then, let's talk about Pearl Jam, because back on the first episode.
Three episodes ago.
Hopefully you're listening to this all in one marathon session. I mentioned in early 91, a high school student commits suicide in front of his class. And that would go on to inspire the song Jeremy by Pearl Jam. Which, if you listened to that episode and couldn't put the pieces together, you've probably never heard Pearl Jam in your life. But Pearl Jam is another one that, yeah, just kind of came out. And again, they were the antithesis of everything that was hair metal. And I think they're the ones that, you know, I for some reason have this quote bouncing around inside my head from Nikki Sixx saying that, like, rock and roll died. I may be making that part of the quote up. But
Paraphrasing,
rock and roll died when musicians stopped looking like rock stars and started looking like guys that just got off work at the gas station. And that's Pearl Jam.
They still had the long hair, but they had the flannel, and they didn't care as much about the image. They just, more about the music, I guess, right?
Yeah, you could have passed them on the street and not, you know, there's a striking difference between what Dave Lee Roth and Vince Neil were wearing on stage and what Eddie Vedder's wearing.
Sure.
But, yeah, Pearl Jam is a, you know, they came out, and much like Kurt, like, they were the anti, I don't know if you want to say anti-establishment, but not so much like tearing down, but just, you know, they stopped making videos after the first album. Mm-hmm. They sued Ticketmaster. Like, they were trying to, I think, focus more, as you said, just on the music aspect instead of being rock stars.
Yeah, and that's true. And was it a welcome change? I mean, because there would have been room for it, because you still would have had, like we discussed, there's still those pop out. You know, Bryan Adams is still mm-hmm. making music, and there's always room for the next pop. Like when Mariah Carey came out, the next starlet, for lack, you know,
diva.
There you go. Okay, I don't know why that word escaped me, but. And your Whitney Houston's and like I said, Madonna, who would have been the biggest star in the world, who used 1991 to just kind of lay low for a bit. And she did her movie. I don't know how laying low, performing at the Oscars and releasing an album all about herself, following her around. But it was weird because I don't know what it was. I mean, maybe it was MTV. Maybe it was. We were listening to rap music, like I said. I was watching Yo MTV Raps every day, but I was still, you know, it wasn't like I turned the channel as soon as the show ended, you know, and it was like, oh, this was Pearl Jam. Did MTV make them, or was MTV forced to make them? I mean, it seemed like that was what the people wanted. Maybe people had gone through the 80s, which we both love, you know, and obviously there was a lot of great music in the 80s, and I still think it's the best decade for one-hit wonders that you're ever going to find. But maybe people wanted something that was a little bit more substantive, you know, had a little bit more, it was a little more deeper to it. For Christ's sakes, this band had done this hit single about a kid who killed himself in the front of the classroom. Like, I don't know the Culture Club was doing that, right? You know, I don't know. I could be totally wrong. I hope I'm not dissing Men Without Hats here. You know, like, it's just, it seemed like they wanted to, maybe they were using that, the true life, for inspiration, but then also just, yeah, trying to make something a little bit deeper.
Yeah, well, as we discussed last time too, it's, you have a changing landscape, not only, you know, politically, but also just the person listening to music as people grow up, as a new generation comes along that is looking for new music to call their own.
That's very true.
And I think that's one of the biggest, and I think that's why you see trends change every, on average, 6-7 years, is you have a new generation who is looking for their own. Like, they don't want to, a lot of them, and I may be generalizing here, don't want to listen to things that their parents listen to or their older siblings. They want them to have the, you know, it's, you're looking for that band that you can say, oh, I discovered this band.
That's true. And that's essentially Generation X, right? Would you say that Nirvana, Pearl Jam is sort of the Generation X? And what I find interesting is you look at 1991, I mean, I guess it would have been more in 92. I remember Saturday Night Live doing a sketch, may have been in 91, where it was a Democratic primary, and they had all these Democrats coming up there, and the title of the title of the program was, you know, 1992 Democratic primary, or who's going to lose to Bush in the election. Like, it was an afterthought. Like, Bill, I don't even know if people knew who Bill Clinton was in 1991, unless you were really kind of paying attention to some of that landscape. And so at the same time where Generation X kind of comes out and they adapt this sort of grunge music, I wonder if they also adopted Bill Clinton as somebody, because they'd seen Reagan for 8 years and then Bush for another four. And I remember Bush was supposed to just win again. Like, it wasn't even a thought. And then all of a sudden, don't they always say that, like, one of the reasons Bill Clinton won was Arsenio Hall and his appearance on MTV and getting young people and motivated.
I believe, I want to say the Rock the Vote campaign would have started in 91, 92. Mm-hmm. Like, that would have, and yeah, but again, with alternative music coming out and people like Eddie Vedder being more politically outspoken, whereas, you know, your heavy metal bands aren't, you know, no one was endorsing Dukakis or Mondale in 84 and 88.
No, they didn't do, I mean, do you remember like Madonna doing stuff for like, I'm not going to wear fur. Like, she was always, did hair bands ever do that? Did hair bands ever, like, I'm not saying it as a bad thing, but did hair bands ever really take a stand?
I don't think musicians really took a stand until then. And, you know, Alice Cooper has gone on record as saying, like, it's treason against rock and roll to be political, because you're like, you're there to provide entertainment, not to espouse politics.
Yeah.
Because people, and you have to realize that your audience is divided between both, both. So by taking a stance on, I mean, we can look at the Dixie Chicks, bringing it back then. You make a political statement, you alienate part of your fan base.
Part of the fan base. Unless you are, like, I always bring it back to, I say Public Enemy is one of the most important bands ever, because they incited, you know, they inspired a lot of young people to be more motivated and, you know, politically. But yeah, it's kind of funny because that's where the Alice Cooper quote is kind of funny, because I just think, like, because the whole point of rock music is sort of trying to, like, be an anti-establishment. And to this day, I still find it so ironic that Bruce Springsteen, that one of his biggest hits was Born in the USA. Mm-hmm. And to this, politicians
still use it
as this hit. And if you look at the song, it's all about how bad how bad things were for them. And especially when like the right wing side, the traditionalists tried to adapt that song, and it's like, no, I think that song was kind of about the policies, especially of the Reagan administration. Yeah. But it just says it's Born in the USA. They look at the title.
That title.
And
yeah.
Every time a politician uses it, Springsteen has to come out and say, "I never endorse this politician. Please stop playing my music," and they never do. You know.
And I will say right now, for the record, if a politician wants my vote in any election, he will use "Elected" by Alice Cooper as his theme song.
Instant vote for
Instant
Chad.
Vote.
Yeah, vote smart.
Yeah, that's. Vote Smart 2020, a better vision for America. Yeah, I think it's, you know, we've just hit on probably an epiphany of why music was changing, is just in your political, your sociological landscape, everything is changing. Trends, you know, out. I'm trying to think of what the clothing trends of the early, late 80s, and now we're going into the oversized pants and shirts, but...
How many black t-shirts did you have in the late 80s? Black rock and metal band t-shirts?
I had a lot.
Did you ever... Now, in 1991, did you ever have a pair of overalls? Because I did.
Painted overalls? Or just overalls?
Because
I had... A friend and I went... we were out one day at the mall, and one store had overalls that had, like, graffiti paint on them. And so we bought them, and then we wore them out that night, and we got mocked mercilessly. That's the word. And I don't think I ever wore them again.
I had overalls that were shorts, and at the time there were some people. No one ever wore both straps buckled. There'd usually be one strap. Sometimes people would have both straps down and then have them reattached at your thighs to the front of the bib. So I mean, yeah, I mean, I think again we probably had different. You come from a small town in Illinois. I would have been in
That's
Hawaii.
That's probably why I was being mocked for wearing
overalls. I mean, overalls were popular in Hawaii in 91.
Well, yeah. I mean, overalls were popular in a farming community, just not the ones that I was wearing.
The proper usage of the of the overalls.
If I would have had a cow with me, it would have been better.
Yeah. Why didn't big wading boots ever become a style like that? I don't know.
I am sure there are photos out there somewhere that will hopefully never see the light of day. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's been interesting these past three episodes to look back on this year of 91, because again, looking back now and seeing the hindsight and seeing how things change, it's kind of obvious to see the change and see why. But at the time, it's kind of like right now where we're in this transition phase of what's going to happen next. And I'm sure in 20 years we can all look back and say, oh, well, you look at this event and it all plays
out. What did your parents think of Nirvana? Did they have a thought on them? Pearl Jam?
My parents don't listen to music. I mean, my dad would listen to country music when we were in the car, and that's it. My mom took my sister to some country concerts in the 90s, like Brian White, Tim McGraw, Faith Hill, but...
Well, here's the thing, and I guess we should have mentioned this earlier, and this might be a good last segment, but in 1991, how old were your parents?
91. 40. My mom would have been late 30s, my dad would have been early 40s.
And you are now, today?
Old. I'm early 40s, yeah.
Well, it's funny, I don't know why I didn't think of this sooner, but I'm 41 years old. My parents were 41 years old in 1991. Oh. And, you know, this idea that like, What their thoughts on my music? I told you, my father took away my Eazy-E cassette because he walked in right on a cuss word, and it was a song that only had one cuss word in it. And he caught it, and he took it away, and then he gave it back to me several months later. But he, to this day, he still refers to rap as rap crap, like it's one word. And I'm sure I don't remember him ever having a thought on Nirvana and Pearl Jam as well, either. And yet, it always gets me that to this day right now, I know people who. Totally, people my age, or maybe a few years younger, they love making fun of Justin Bieber, you know, or Taylor Swift. And I look at it and go, oh, I mean, how is it any different than listening to the New Kids on the Block? I dig Taylor Swift. Bieber, I haven't really discovered Bieber. I haven't tried to listen to his music.
Yeah, I know he had a song out this last year called Love Yourself, which I did not know was him the first couple times I heard it on the radio. And I'm like, this is a good song. But I'm with you. You know, I have seen Taylor Swift in concert a couple times. I've seen New Kids on the Block a few times. And both put on... really good shows.
Yeah. And you and I both went to the NHL All-Star game, and during the skills competition on the All-Star Saturday, they had a celebrity game, and Justin Bieber was in that game, and there were fans around us. There was a fan maybe 3 or 4 sections in front of us that was probably our age, and he had his children with him who were probably around 10, 11 years old, and he's booing Bieber during the celebrity game. Number one, what do you care? And number two, you got a kid there. Like, what kind of influence you want to set on your kid that you're booing some other dude? Yeah,
number three, Bieber is Canadian. Like, he belongs in the hockey rink. Like, yeah. It's just natural.
It's just so easy to sort of poke fun at him.
It goes back to what I was saying earlier about people who only listen to one genre of music who hate everything else because it's not what they listen to. Mm-hmm. And in today's society where hating or trolling is, looked at as a positive thing.
Yeah, but it's weird to think. Like, neither you or I have children, and yet when our parents were our age, they were raising us and talking about the music we've discussed for the last three episodes was the music that they were just scoffing and ignoring. And yet, I like to think that I'm not completely ignoring the music that's out today, but I don't have any kids that would be listening to it that could tell me. And my sister has two grown children. And they're in their early 20s. They're listening to the music that she grew up listening to because she just raised them. I mean, maybe they kind of discovered their own stuff, but they kind of found themselves liking a lot more of the music that she liked.
Yeah.
What are the kids listening to right now, you know, that we're ignoring? I don't know.
I don't know.
That's the whole point. You know, it's subconsciously. You know, we're not trying to ignore it, but we are because we're still listening to the music we had from the 90s or the other bands that are still around from the 90s that we like.
Well, and we've mentioned this before, and we're going off tangent here kind of bit, but whatever. It's my show. We'll do what we want. MTV doesn't play videos like they used to. I don't listen to the radio. Like, I've been I've been in Los Angeles for 10 years. My preset radio stations in my car are still set to whatever the factory default was.
Okay.
I don't listen to the radio, so discovering new music, the only way that I really do it is, you know, when I first moved to LA, going out to small clubs or, you know, the Roxy, the Whiskey, and seeing bands and being like, oh, kind of like when we went to the Opry and saw Striking Matches. Like, yeah. I don't know who this band is, but I am interested in finding out now.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't go to as many small shows as I used to. Now everything is more arena-based of bands that I am familiar with, and unless they have an opener that I don't know that I get introduced to, I don't know what music is out there.
And if the music industry model that we have in place currently was in place in 1991, oof, I don't want to imagine how many bands we would have never have heard of. Never.
Yeah.
You know, especially some of those some of those obscure, smaller hip-hop acts. You know, could grunge have gotten that big? I have a hard time thinking it. I think it would have... You would have had just, you know, maybe some of those hip-hop artists, maybe some of the grunge artists, you'd have your hipster friends that would be listening to them, mm-hmm. but you'd still have, you know, the Bryan Adams or whatnot would be the equivalent of, would be like U2. U2 put out an album in 1991, and they're still making albums now. You know, it's kind of bizarre to imagine, like, the reason that some of those bands were so big in 1991 was because we had so much more access to the music.
Yeah, and we've posed this question before, is in 30 years, or 27 years, 26, what bands that are popular now will still be playing arenas? Which ones will still be playing county fairs or, you know, yeah. or what bands are just going to fade away? Because the music that I see that is out there, with the exception of, you know, like a Taylor Swift or an Ed Sheeran, like, how many of these bands have sustainability?
That's the thing. There's going to be some. I just think there has to be. That's just the way music is built. Yeah. And I think it's too easy for people that are our age to look and have the mindset. You just posed the question, but you didn't say none of them will be big. You just said which one will be big.
Yeah.
It always bugs me when people just say, oh, none of them will be big. Well, how do we know?
Yeah.
Because that's the same thing as our parents telling us that Pearl Jam, no one's going to listen to them in 30 years. Well, here we are. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm very curious, like you said, who is going to be big? We'll never know, because it's always so bizarre how these trends change. Which one of these artists, is Taylor Swift going to be able to adapt her image? Is Lady Gaga going to get bored and just go into acting? Yeah, who knows?
I don't know. We'll have to come back in 26 years and do a follow-up episode to find out. Wow. So we got three episodes on 1991. I'm very impressed. So I want to thank Mike DeKalb for joining me for these past 3 weeks.
Thank you, Jed.
Again, you can find him on Twitter at Mike DeKalb. That's MikeDeKalb. Or you can look at his website, hockeytransplant.com. We got the new NHL season starting in a few weeks.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's going to be a lot of travel time in there. You follow the blog, you'll know more about that. I have a few more interesting dissertations of pop culture coming in the next couple of weeks that I'm very interested to see how they play out. And, again, I thank you for listening. And, you know, go to iTunes, subscribe, go to the Jittery Monkey podcast, jitterymonkey.com. Listen to the other shows here on the Jittery Monkey Podcasting Network. My name is Chad Smart. You can find me on Twitter at Chad Smart. It's very simple. Let me know what you thought of 1991, and if you have any ideas for future episodes of year breakdowns, let me know. Until next time, question everything, do something positive.
This is a production of the Jittery Monkey Podcast Network. For more jittery shenanigans, go to jitterymonkey.com.